KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a talk by Alex Vitale on Saturday, October 12th at the Dismantle Change Build Center in Portland. Alex Vitale, director of the Brooklyn College Policing and Social Justice Project, is the author of The End of Policing. He'll be speaking on how to reconstruct police culture and behavior and describe alternatives that remove the police from dealing with drug addiction, houselessness, sex work, mental health crises, and more. Again, that's Alex Vitale on Saturday, October 12th, 6 p.m. at the Dismantle Change Build Center, 14 Northeast Killingsworth in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor an Evening with Ken Stringfellow on Saturday, October 19th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Hollywood Senior Center in Portland. Ken Stringfellow, founding member of the Posies, performs songs from his 30-year career as a musician. This night features songs and stories from his work as a solo artist, as well as Neil Young, Big Star, Robin Hitchcock, and much more. Again, that's an Evening with Ken Stringfellow on Saturday, October 19th from 7 to 9 at the Hollywood Senior Center, 1820 Northeast 40th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's so unguided with the hope that someone's reading.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 9:01. Coming up next is one of my new shows called Keeping Up with Portland. It's about the 3.96 code change proposal regarding neighborhood associations. All right, here it goes. Stay tuned. Good morning and welcome to KBOO Radio's new show, Keeping Up with Portland with Claire Rosciato. I'm Claire Rosciato and today's show is about the City's Office of Community and Civic Life 3.96 code change proposal that would no longer only recognize neighborhood associations. The current code began in 1974, which started the Office of Neighborhood Associations. Over the past year, the Office of Community and Civic Life has been working to, as they say, expand recognition and increase inclusion among the Portland community. Next month, on November 14th, Commissioner Chloe Daly, who's in charge of the Office of Community and Civic Life, will present the code change to the council. At this point, however, for the code change proposal to pass, it would require at least 3 votes from City Council, and it's not quite yet clear if those votes are a possibility. Before I begin, I want to let listeners know, while this show is informative, it just slices the surface of this issue given it is only a half-hour show, and at the end, I'll provide resources for you to do some of your own additional research and form your own conclusions. This code change proposal has been very divisive among the Portland community. Some community members strongly support the code change, believing it will help remedy what they believe is a broken system with neighborhood associations, while others strongly oppose the code change proposal because of the city's outreach and the new code change language. As I'm sure many of you know, have been keeping up with this story, are aware that Commissioner Udaly has struggled to gain the respect and support of this proposal that she's pioneering. While there's much to discuss regarding the criticism of Commissioner Udaly and how she's conducted herself throughout this process, today's show will instead primarily focus on the current code and what the code change proposal will mean if passed for the Portland community and the future of neighborhood associations. First, I spoke with Wintu Johannes, a policy advisor with Commissioner Chloe Udaly's office, who worked on the code change proposal. And here's what she has to say about what this code change is and what it potentially means for the Portland community.
The conversation has largely been around neighborhood associations. I think it's helpful to remember that this code is actually about civic engagement more broadly, and that neighborhood associations represent one way of civic engagement, but that the purpose of this code change is to think about what civic engagement means more broadly as well, why that structure does not work for them. And I think that I know that what's on the table now is saying we as city government are investing in and creating a program. And if we know that it doesn't serve everyone, it's our job to make sure that other groups are being heard too. It's not the job of volunteer neighborhood association members who are often doing good work in their community. This is it's the government's responsibility to address.
Up next in my interview with Winto Johannes, she explains the next steps if the code were to pass. She begins by referencing the last section of the code, 3.96.060. If you'd like to read this, it's on the homepage on the Office of Community and Civic Life. This is the section that defines which groups are recognized and how they are added to the list recognized by the city. This has often been the most controversial section of the code that some code change opposers feel is not clear enough, while supporters believe it is more inclusive by adding neighborhood groups. This is what it states, quote, "For the purposes of recognizing organizations as identified in other sections of city code, the director must adopt a list of recognized organizations by administrative rule, including but not limited to neighborhood associations, district coalitions, business district associations, and diverse and civic leadership partners existing on the effective date of this code chapter. Addition or deletion of an organization from this list must be made by council ordinance," end quote. Now, here's more with my interview with Winto Johannes on this topic.
The last section, section 060, is really important because what it does is it says we recognize that we need to adopt better models, mm-hmm. and until we do that, we need to preserve what we have. And so what will come to council with the code change ordinance is a resolution. And what the resolution will do is it will convene a multi-bureau work group. So it says these benefits, our role, the Office of Community and Civic Life, their role is to identify groups. But the actual benefits come from other bureaus. And so through this multi-bureau work group, we should identify what are the benefits that we give. Can we change how we give them to reach more people? And in some instances, bureaus are already doing that. So, for example, rely on lists of recognized or not recognized groups. Can we say that our list of recognized groups are a starting point, and we know that that's not enough? And so can we have technology that allows people to subscribe to notifications in their neighborhood? You know, I think that that kind of thinking, though, the Bureau, Office of Community and Civic Life, can't do on its own. It actually has to have the other bureaus at the table, and that's what the next chapter of this would look like, is saying our current structure is preserved so that everyone continues to get the same notifications and information, and we think we can do better. And so this multi-bureau work group would come back to council with recommendations about how to improve access to those benefits and privileges.
Now, Winto Johannes explains what kind of privileges groups would then receive.
I think, you know, so again, those recommendations would have to come from multi-bureau, from the multi-bureau partnership. But I would point to, for example, the example that Director Ree likes to point to is single-use plastics. Mm-hmm. So if you are someone who cares about single-use plastics, you can actually go on the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability and you can click the box that says send me notifications when there are changes to this policy. So you don't have to even be a part of a recognized group. All the recognized groups will receive that information, but anyone who's interested can also opt in. And so I think that, you know, as that multi-bureau work group reviews what are the benefits, what we'll find is that there are some that are really easy to make available more broadly. Maybe, you know, but to your question about how are people recognized or not recognized in the way that we are doing it now. And I think, you know, in looking at what are the benefits of recognition, so much of it really is around information sharing. And so do we need to say to community groups, we will give you information if you meet, you know, XYZ conditions? Or is it our job as government to simply give that information to community groups who want it? And so I think that, you know, again, if we only focus on one type of organizing, there are so many other Portlanders that we miss. And, you know, my message over and over is that we don't have to choose.
Next, I spoke with Sabina Erdes, who is both the chair of Lent's Neighborhood Association and the founder of a neighborhood nonprofit called East Portland Collective. Urdes says that she does not support the code change. First, I asked how she found out about the code change proposal.
I found out from conversations in the community. I found out from chairs of other neighborhood associations who reached out and said, hey, do you know this? Do you know what's going on? Are you in the loop? And started a conversation and made everyone aware. That's how I learned about it. And that's when I started looking more into it to educate myself on what's going on. For me, process is very important in every instance. You know, it's been something that I've tried to change with our neighborhood association in terms of just being transparent about how we do things, including how we handle funds. Mm-hmm. Last year, we, you know, got support from a nonprofit advisor and a CPA to just kind of do an, for the lack of a better word, an audit of our finances and share that, publish that, share it with the community, do a report. So I like transparency and I like involving the community. And I think that any code change should reflect the vision of the community. And the way this process has been conducted so far, it just seems like it's the vision of, I'm not sure, Chloe Udaly, you know, the bureau director, Sue Curie. I'm not sure exactly whose vision it is, but it doesn't seem like it's representative of everyone in our city. I think that we should all be thankful to the committee that they put in, to the people of that committee who've put work into, you know, supporting the vision of creating a more
something more inclusive.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And came from the outside with a fresh perspective. Great. Mm-hmm. And, you know, bringing in voices that aren't typically heard. Great. But what would it have been the harm in also reaching out to neighborhood associations? Because we have lived experience with the current system. So, and we might also have, you know, notes of how we can improve this mm-hmm. based on obstacles that we've run into.
Next, Sabina Urdes shares her concern for how neighborhood associations lack support for training with issues such as grievances and how this eats away at city time and money. She also points out this could leave little funding for potential neighborhood organizations if the new code passes.
Okay, I hear what your motivation is. I hear what your vision is. How do we know this is going to work? What will these look like in practice? Because we know that that was a downside of the previous standards. You know, we had to figure out a lot of things along the way because my neighborhood, you know, is a lot of people in my neighborhood are very active. And I guess a downside is that some people have the ability right now to weaponize some of the standards in order to create hardships for a neighborhood association or for board members.
What do you mean by that?
So, for example, people can file quote unquote grievances mm-hmm. against, you know, a board member or an action taken by the board. Grievances, you know, is supposed to be something very specific. So it can't just be any kind of complaint. Someone has to have been harmed in some way. And you know, they have to seek some sort of resolution. And so we had a lot of people filing grievances against us. And no one even knew what the process is for that the process for addressing grievances
was. When you say no one knew, you mean the neighborhood association itself?
The neighborhood association, it was kind of confusing how it was being handled and unclear if we even have to handle it and how. And I really wanted to do it the proper way, so I got a lot of training and a lot of guidance from mm-hmm. Paul Leisner, and then learned that doing it the proper way with, you know, setting up a team to look at the grievance, potentially meeting with the person who filed the grievance, then, you know, deliberating, coming up with a report, presenting the report. The report is very dense and all that, and it's very time consuming, very cumbersome, very demoralizing. And not everything that is a complaint is necessarily a grievance. So, you know, if some people filed 10, 12, 20, I think there's a person who currently has, you know, over 20 grievances against us. Wow. They can make it very hard for us to conduct actual business. Mm-hmm. And they also take up a lot of resources from the city. So I can understand, you know, the perspective of city staff that's saying this is not sustainable. This is just one neighborhood association that's going through this. What if we had to deal with this for 95? Then let's say we were able to, but what is that taking resources away from? What about all the other groups that, yes, congregate based on their identity, or, you know, and they just want to do good things? How are we going to have anything left for them? So I understand that part, but I think that the solution is consulting everyone, including the neighborhood association, in this process, and offering more support to all of us instead of less.
The current language is that they're not unrecognizing neighborhood associations.
Right.
They're expanding the definition of who's recognized. Do you agree that? Do you disagree with that term and all that language? Do you not believe that's what's going to happen?
I know that that's what they say, but by eliminating the language around neighborhood associations, which is what they did with the initial proposal, it sounds like they have since added something, but initially that was why there was so much uproar. It was because, oh, well, you're not getting rid of neighborhood associations per se, but you're eliminating all the language around neighborhood associations. So now they're not really included in the code, and you're eliminating requirements for open, you know, public meeting laws and all that. So
the specifics that still exist and...
Yeah.
Right.
And I'm just unclear how doing that is going to support, the inclusivity of voices that haven't been heard so far. And I think that's very real. I think that is true, that the renters or people of color, people who don't speak English, parents, all kinds of categories of people have been left out of that process. So I think that's valid. But something I have asked, you know, Winta has been, so how will we know, what is your measure of success? How will we know if this process has worked? If this change that you're trying to make, how will we know that it worked? What is your accountability to our community? Ultimately, at the end, how will we see if, you know, what you've changed has worked? And they haven't been able to give me an answer to that yet. Because I think they should be accountable to us. They should be accountable to the community. And if there are misunderstandings about, I mean, no doubt there are, I think, you know, and Winta and Sabrina Wilson have been coming to meetings. They said any association that invites them, neighborhood association, they will come. And they're trying to dispel myths. But I don't understand this general attitude of Chloe Udaly and her staff that people are out to get them. And that, you know, and that we're spreading, the neighborhood associations are now spreading misinformation about the process, when I feel like they should own the fact that they didn't do very well at communicating, they didn't do very well at outreach, that we can do better, that, okay, let's start this over. And like, let's make people feel more inclusive, instead of just having, you know, it be about their vision. And when they come, they just kind of, instead of listening and making people feel heard, they just kind of want to talk and tell us that we're wrong and all that. It's just like, I don't know. It's not been a healthy relationship. And I would love for that to change. But so far, I feel like they, just Chloe Udaly, the statements that she makes and how she engages on social media is not very respectful to our time as volunteers, to the fact that, unlike her and her staff, we don't get paid to do this. It is actually a cost. You know, every time I have to go to City Hall, or every time I have to meet with someone, they've invited me to meet with them and talk to them. And I said, that's a hardship on me. I live in Outer East Portland. It can take an hour just to get downtown. That's gas. Parking is money. And then taking that time away from my work, that's money. And you know, so they said, okay, we'll come meet with you. But it's just like the lack of awareness around the fact that we experience hardships trying to make a change. And that, I think, is what prevents a lot of people from engaging, is that you might not, like, some people are working, you know, what about the single moms working two minimum wage jobs to support their family? And how are they going to be able to engage in this process? How are they going to be able to, you know, feel supported if you're taking away resources? So I would like to see more support, yes, to tearing down some of these barriers, because I think it is possible that just the way neighborhood associations are designed right now, they're mostly accessible to people who perhaps don't have a job, whether they are retired or supported in some capacity, who are middle or upper class, so they can afford to take that time and be there, and who own a house because they're invested in their neighborhood. But it doesn't have to be that way. We can help change that. And neighborhood associations right now are, it seems like, the only channel, the main channel of communication between the community and City Hall. So I just think we need to be very careful of how we approach this change to ensure that people will still be able to engage meaningfully with their local government if we kind of get rid of this channel. Yeah, thank you for taking the time to reach out and, you know, make sure a variety of voices are heard and a variety of angles, and trying to provide this outlet for us all to engage meaningfully and to provide input and ultimately generate more conversation in the community.
Definitely.
Because I think more conversation is what's needed.
I agree. Is there anything I didn't ask you that you feel is important to say or add?
I guess I will say that, you know, in my case, I don't know if I've mentioned this earlier, but I just recently started an organization in my neighborhood that's more identity based. So we center the needs of the LGBTQ community and other marginalized communities. So I guess this should be an interesting experiment in terms of how is civic life going to support us to succeed? Because if this is the direction that we're going into, there should technically be a lot of support for us, and we should technically not have to jump through a lot of hoops to get that support, right? If they're eliminating a bunch of requirements to receive support from the city. So I'm very eager to find out, you know, how this is going to play out, and to basically see how the proposed changes work out in practice.
Lastly, I spoke with Crystal Brim, a former board member of the Richmond Neighborhood Association and a co-change supporter, who shares her experience and what she wants to see for the future of Portland, and addresses some of the criticisms that neighborhood associations are not as inclusive as they could be.
The vast number of people in my experience who are, and myself included, are homeowners. So the charge of being similar to a homeowners association certainly has some merit, more than some merit. And my concern, and I carry this concern as a new board member and as somebody who's lived in a lot of other places, both in other cities in the United States and other places in the world, I carry the point of view of the newcomer as much as I can. Mm-hmm. And as Portland grows and changes, I want to see the newcomer welcomed and have an equal place at the table. And so when we have a board member currently sitting on the neighborhood, the Richmond Neighborhood Association board, who says things like, remember Tom McCall and how he said, Oregon, it's a great place to visit, but I don't even know the exact quote, but I heard it many times growing up as an Oregonian. It was not what I would say is a proud moment or something that current Portlanders should be quoting of one of a state's person, even though we have pride in a lot of things that Tom McCall accomplished. That is not something I want to see repeated on a neighborhood association board. Oregon, come here for a visit, but don't settle and don't stay. That is not something that I am proud of. And I would wager that if Tom McCall were active in Portland civic life now, he would not repeat it, and he would not endorse it anymore. So it is a big concern for me that someone currently seated on the Richmond Neighborhood Association board is saying those sorts of things in public. And I want Portland to be a welcoming place for refugees. In the Richmond neighborhood, we have Catholic Family Services that provides housing for people who are coming from war-torn countries, or who are targeted, had legitimate refugee status. And where are their voices on the Richmond Neighborhood Association board, or where is the outreach to those communities?
There's been a lot of criticism of Commissioner Claudia Daly and the mixture of this heated debate.
Right.
Is there anything that you can share about how you're feeling in support of, maybe in the middle, maybe not in support of, how Commissioner Daly is conducting this proposal outreach?
Well, you know, I would like to hear, I'm going to pivot and say I would like to hear from the other commissioners, because this is not just about her office. It's about, there was an entire committee of people who made this recommendation, and it's not just about, you know, even though that she's in charge of that office at the moment, our form of city government also rotates commissioners among those seats. So every one of those commissioners should be pretty abreast of what's going on. And so I would like to hear statements and considered statements from Nick Fish, Joanne Hardesty, and so on and so forth. And there's an election coming up, clearly, so I think political opportunity is playing into some of the ways that people are responding.
Or possibly not responding.
Or not responding to this. And that's a pity, because this is a citywide concern, and it should be something that is of concern beyond the political expediency of the moment.
This has been Clara Schotto with Keeping Up with Portland. As promised, here are some resources for different perspectives on this issue. If you're someone who has a little bit more reading time, there's a report called Civic Life Conversation Report, Current Code. This offers a very thorough, in-depth understanding of what the code change proposal looked like from the perspective of the city. You can find that at www.portlandoregon.gov/citycode/28460. If you're looking to find perspectives from those who support the code change from community members, you can find that at changethecodepdx. If you're looking for the perspective of those who oppose the code change, you can find that at Keep Portland Neighborly. You're tuned in to community-supported KBOO Community Radio. Coming up next is God Science.
Welcome to the Got Science podcast. I'm your host, Colleen MacDonald. Ever wondered what GPS, laser printers, and nuclear bombs have in common? Well, today's guest ties it all together. And stick around after the interview for another installment of This Week in Science History with Katie Love. At the second Democratic Party presidential debate, moderators asked Senator Elizabeth Warren about her support for no first use, a policy stating that the U.S. will never be the first to use nuclear weapons in a conflict. That night, a lot of folks watching, who might not have realized that this wasn't already policy, learned for the first time that the U.S. can start a nuclear war on its own. Still, there's nothing new about the fight to control nuclear risk. You could even say it's as old as the hydrogen bomb itself. But maybe the best way to understand how the threat began, where it's taken us, and where we must never let it take us, is to talk to the scientist who was instrumental in building the first hydrogen bomb, Dr. Richard Garwin. Dr. Garwin is a physicist who knows very well what nuclear weapons are capable of and understands even better the importance of preventing their use. We spoke about why he began testifying before Congress and giving advice to presidents, and how this work sparked a decades-long partnership with the Union of Concerned Scientists beginning in the 1980s. While his name may be new to some listeners, I bet you've already interacted with some of the technology he helped develop through the years. It's a long list, including color monitors, MRI, touchscreens, laser printers, and a personal favorite of mine, GPS. Dr. Garwin's work earned him a National Medal of Science and the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He's served on the UCS Board of Directors for 20 years, and he's one of only a few scientists to be elected to all three U.S. national academies, the National Academy of Science, the National Academy of Medicine, and the National Academy of Engineering. Perhaps author Joel Shurkin described him best in the title of his 2017 biography, True Genius: The Life and Work of Richard Garwin, the Most Influential Scientist You've Never Heard of. So now, let's hear from him. Dick, welcome to the Got Science podcast.
Good to be here.
I hope you don't mind that I'm calling you Dick and not Dr.
You gotta call
Garwin.
Me something.
Well, you were involved in the development of the hydrogen bomb in 1951. But before we get to that, could you set the stage for us? I know you were a graduate student of Enrico Fermi, who is referred to as the architect of the nuclear age, or maybe the father of the nuclear age. I've seen it both ways. He produced the first controlled nuclear chain reaction in December 1942, and that ultimately led to the creation of the nuclear bomb. Can you talk about that time in history and your involvement?
My involvement with Enrico Fermi started in spring of 1947, when I began my graduate work in physics at the University of Chicago. I had just graduated from Case Institute of Technology, now Case Western Reserve in Cleveland. I had just gotten married to my wife of what would be 70 years. She died a year ago. And we moved together to Chicago for my graduate work. I was an experimenter. My father had a shop in the garage of a newly built house in Cleveland in 1940, and he did audio and visual work for the schools and business in the Cleveland area. And I helped, you know, after school and high school on weekends and whatnot. So I was familiar with using my hands and electronics and whatnot. After a few months in graduate school at Chicago, I got itchy. There was no lab work. And so I went to one of the professors, Fermi, and I said, look, I'm really good at this. Maybe I could help you. And he took me on. So I finished my PhD in December of 1949, and I was appointed to the faculty in physics at the University of Chicago. But they only paid 9 months a year. And by then, I had a six-month-old baby, and my wife and the baby and I ate 12 months a year. So when Fermi said, perhaps you could come with me and be a consultant to Los Alamos, I jumped at the chance, and was wonderful because a small community in the mountains of New Mexico. So we went in June 1950 for 3 months, and in 1951 for 4 months, and in 1952 for 5 months, at which time I decided that I didn't really like particle physics anymore with the Chicago cyclotron, and had a job interview for a new solid-state physics laboratory at Columbia University operated by IBM. So I began my 40-year career with IBM in the New York area in December 1952. But by then, I had been for 3 months at Los Alamos. My wife says that I had spoken with Fermi about some suggestions for nuclear weapons, and he said that we couldn't talk about it at Chicago, but if I came to Los Alamos, we could. So I did, and I spent the first week reading in the Classified Report Library all of the weekly progress reports during the war and in the 5 years following the August 1945 use of nuclear weapons against Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So I knew everything about the nuclear weapons of the time.
What was it like being a recent graduate, and you're now at Los Alamos with a group of, I would imagine, pretty heavy-hitting physicists? What was the atmosphere like there?
Most of the famous people who were there during the war left in 1945 to go back to their universities and pick up their scientific research. So people who were there full-time, Hans Bethe from Cornell, Edward Teller, who then was recruited to the University of Chicago, Fermi himself had only come, I think, in 1944 because he was busy at Chicago designing the plutonium production reactors for the Hanford site in Washington State.
So Los Alamos was a lab. There was a lab there. Were you building?
Yeah, my first summer actually looking at the program for making thermonuclear weapons, which had been the same ever since 1942. Very poorly funded. Only Edward Teller and a couple of colleagues were working on it. You know, by design, he was denied more resources, and that was right, because in the war, a fission weapon, a nuclear weapon, destroying whole city of Hiroshima or Nagasaki was big enough. And the only way to make a thermonuclear weapon that gets its energy by combining light elements, heavy hydrogen, deuterium, to make helium, rather than fissioning heavy elements like uranium or plutonium. So that would be enough, and you need a nuclear weapon, a fission weapon, to initiate a thermonuclear weapon, the classical super. So I looked at the data, and the reaction cross-section for deuterium and tritium was measured in 1939 at the University of Texas, and I decided that wasn't sufficiently accurate. So I, on my own initiative, I started building an apparatus for doing a precision measurement down to lower energies for the thermonuclear reactions. And I had to leave, of course, in September, and the laboratory director, Norris Bradbury, decided that they would continue this. And they had a very good experiment based on my design. Then in 1951, from the University of Chicago, I went first for a month to the Korean War in March, April 1951 to see what laboratories the Tactical Air Command that had just been formed could use and what they should do in these laboratories. And then went with my wife and son to Los Alamos again. And there I asked Edward Teller what had happened since I left in September. And he said, well, you know, Stan Ulam and I wrote this paper, March 9, 1951, called Radiation Mirrors and Hydrodynamic Lenses, a different way of making hydrogen bombs. That will surely work, but I need an experiment. I need you to design an experiment that will leave no doubt that this will work. So I looked at the paper, and I worked on it for a while and tried to design a small-scale experiment. So in July 25th, 1951, I published a secret paper at Los Alamos, and it was a four-page memo and a big fold-out drawing of a hydrogen bomb test. And the laboratory deemed that the right way to go, and it was built and tested November 1, 1952. So that was the beginning of thermonuclear weapons in the world.
After these weapons were built, were you fearful then that they would be used and that people would be killed? I guess the reason I'm asking this is because when I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and I remember as a kid being afraid, being scared that we could potentially be destroyed by a nuclear weapon.
Well, I was only 22 when I went to Los Alamos the first time, and I was 23 when I designed the Mike test that became the thermonuclear weapon. Ironically, it was after I moved to IBM in December of 1952 that IBM asked me to look at the extension of the air defense of the United States against sea lines of approach of the Soviet bombers armed with nuclear weapons. And these people were very well connected in Washington. And so we would go down and get threat briefings from the intelligence agencies and ultimately, you know, briefed people in the White House and State Department and Defense Department. And so I learned what Soviet nuclear weapons could do against the United States. And yes, it did make me very fearful, and decided when I was 25 or so in 1955, maybe a little older, we had bought a house. And I remember walking around the bedroom and saying to myself, what do I want to do with my life? What's most important? Well, it's the family. It's the environment. It's the political stability of the government, because if you don't have that, you don't have assured survival of a family, and you can't do anything about the environment. So I decided I would work to preserve and improve all these things. So that's a lot of the background of my work with UCS over the decades.
We'll be back in a minute with the second half of our interview. The Got Science podcast is brought to you by the Union of Concerned Scientists. More at gotsciencepodcast.org. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, PRX, SoundCloud, and all the usual podcast outlets. For a transcript or links to additional resources from this episode and a full bio of our guest, head over to gotsciencepodcast.org. If you have a sec, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It's one of the best ways to help Got Science get noticed. It's quick and super easy. When you open Got Science in your podcast app, scroll down to the bottom to ratings and reviews and leave a comment. And finally, if you're on Twitter, come talk to us at GotScienceUCS. Now let's get back to our interview.
I want to pivot a little bit to your becoming more of a public figure and testifying. And tell me, was there a pivotal moment where you felt that you needed to speak out?
Probably it was the ABM controversy, anti-ballistic missile controversy of 1968. That was a time when I realized that for more than 10 years, we'd been writing these annual reports from the Strategic Military Panel of PSAC, going to the National Security Advisor and the President, saying, here is the Army's current plan for deploying a missile defense of the entire country, and here's why it won't work, either because it doesn't have the capacity to handle the missiles, or it can't discriminate, or too expensive. And we didn't really understand that the proposal of the Johnson administration in 1968 to deploy a nationwide defense against Chinese ballistic missiles armed with nuclear weapons, which were not a threat then. In fact, I think it was 11 years after that that the Chinese tested their first ICBM. But we felt that defending individual cities with nuclear-armed interceptors, everybody would want to be defended. But we got that entirely wrong. Everybody didn't want nuclear weapons defending them. And so it became very unpopular. And when the Nixon administration came in, they realized this. They repurposed the defense to defend the Minuteman silos, which was perfectly okay, except the system that they were building wasn't appropriate for the purpose because it was itself much more vulnerable than the silos. So that was the time when I really felt that you had to inform the Congress, you had to inform the incoming staff of every presidential administration.
So I'd like to switch gears and talk about some of the other work that you've done throughout the years. I was listening to another podcast called 50 Things That Made the Modern Economy, and the episode was about the iPhone. Now, they discussed a list of 12 important breakthroughs, and you had a substantial hand in several of them, including GPS and touchscreens. Tell me about that.
On GPS, the Global Positioning System, my military aircraft panel in the mid-1960s introduced the concept of bombing by navigation. So in wartime, you drop bombs from your aircraft. This was at the time of the Vietnam War. I remember going to see the head of the Air Force and asking him, do you know where your bombs are falling? And it turned out that half of the bombs could not be located. We had no idea where they fell. And the other half had a circle of equal probability of 700 feet, which means that most of them do no harm at all to their intended target. So the chief of staff of the Air Force said, yeah, 100 feet, CEP. And so I gave him, you know, the synopsis of what we knew. And you could get 100-foot accuracy, and that's what he knew, because there was some radar-directed bombing mm-hmm. with a radar left over from World War II. So we said, look, here we are deploying sensors in Laos by slow propeller aircraft navigating by Loran D, and we get 100-foot CEP with them. And you could do that, or you can have ultimately satellite navigation, and here's what we want. Well, that was 65, 66. In 1980, I wrote the Secretary of the Air Force, whom I knew really very well from when he was a kid, and I said, look, you've reprogrammed $2 million out of your GPS program, and I think that's very bad. Please put it back. And he said, well, I have higher priorities. But the Secretary of Defense, Harold Brown, and the Director of Defense Research and Engineering, Bill Perry, did put the money back. And ultimately, around the year 2000, we got GPS. But my military aircraft panel really had a deployment path in the 1960s, so it would be operational in 1970 or so. The only thing we missed was mapping the world, because that was infeasible with the storage capacity that we had at that time. So we completely missed the widest use of GPS in Google Maps or whatnot. But the essential thing is that it knows where the objects on the Earth are. And on touchscreens in the late 1970s, I decided that that was really the way to go, not for portable devices, but for PCs. IBM was just introducing the IBM PC, and my colleague at IBM, Jim Levine, and I decided that we would demonstrate touchscreens. And we had several technologies, including a laser scanned, which was my favorite, touchscreen, or other approaches. And we demonstrated them all. We couldn't get IBM to pick this up. We tried. They were really very big on automated teller machines. And if you're over 40 years old, you know, you can't, you know, see clearly on the screen and then look over to the keyboard and put in the numbers that you're trying to remember. So we programmed up our touch screen so that all you needed to do was to touch the keyboard. And people said, well, you know, you'll have the impressions on the keyboard where you've been touching. So easy. You move the soft keyboard from one place to another. Or they said, you know, you get smudges on the screen. And sure, but look at this black screen on my phone. And we said, don't fade to black, fade to gray. And you find it impossible to see the smudges. And maybe people won't like a dirty screen. They might get germs. Well, how about the dirty keyboard? What do you want?
So, Dick, you have an incredible background working on military applications and advising presidents. And what, in your opinion, do we need to do to keep our country, the world, people safe?
Well, we have to recognize the threats. We have to recognize the limits of our own capability in understanding and moving things. We need to recognize the fragility of civilization developed through the ages, and that if you don't like the way things are, destroying it and starting over is not a good idea, because we are the result of a long period of generations of evolution, natural and cultural. And the things that work are the ones that have been selected for. You can't always get your own way.
In what fields or areas do you think the next great scientific discoveries will be?
Predicting the future is always difficult. In fact, I think Niels Bohr said prediction is difficult, especially the future. And except in communist societies and maybe some of the aberrations in U.S. society now, where the future is certain, it's going to be perfection of our society, the past is unknowable. That used to be a joke. So it's very humbling to look at the cell phone and see what's happened. There was in the Office of Science and Technology very early somebody who had the fantastic idea of cell phones. And, you know, I said, like people who asked Alexander Graham Bell, who said people in Maine could talk to people in Florida. And the question was, well, what would they have to say to one another? And in order to talk on cell phones, why do you need to do that? You have all these phones along the streets and whatnot, pay phones. You could improve their performance and whatnot. But it was totally impossible at that time to predict what was going to happen. The merger of personal digital assistants, which would do arithmetic and store things for you, like telephone numbers that you could then put into your telephone. But to understand all the things that came together in order to make a cell phone. So when you talk about predicting technology, it's really humbling.
So do you think there are any areas of science that shouldn't be explored?
It's hard to know what to avoid. I don't go so far as Edward Teller, who felt that everything should be explored and brought to the point of production and test before society decides not to do it, including nuclear weapons, nuclear hand grenades, or things like that. And yet, on the other hand, there's the view of Matt Meselson, a longtime professor of biochemistry at Harvard. He received the Future of Life 2019 award for his work in bringing us the 1972 convention banning biological weapons, which came about because of his influence on PSAC and his friend Paul Doty and me and others, and Henry Kissinger, who was Nixon's national security advisor, to have President Nixon do the unlikely thing of unilaterally abandoning not only the use of biological weapons, but also research and development on offensive biological weapons. Despite naysayers who said, well, there goes the prospect of an international treaty now that the United States is doing it unilaterally, what incentive does the Soviet Union have in joining an international treaty? But the Soviet Union signed almost immediately. I think they didn't believe that we were serious, and it took them a long time really to abandon their biological weapons, but it's now almost universally implemented. So I think you have to explore a lot of things. We're not smart enough to understand what not to do. There are some no-nos, and genetic manipulation of people is one of them, because it's pretty hard to control at this stage of knowledge what goes on.
Well, Dick, thank you for joining me. I want to personally thank you for GPS, because I have the worst sense of direction of anyone that I know, and it has really helped me a lot in my life.
Okay, thank you very much. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. And now it's time for This Week in Science History with Katie Love.
This week in science history, we're going back to October 5th, 1960. When a U.S. early warning radar reported dozens of Soviet missiles heading for the United States. At the time, our missiles were, and they continue to be, on hair trigger alert, a U.S. military policy that enables the rapid launch of nuclear weapons. Missiles on hair trigger alert are maintained in a ready-for-launch status, staffed by around-the-clock launch crews, and can be airborne in as few as 10 minutes. So, when the U.S. radar systems reported an all-out nuclear attack by the Soviet Union, with 99.9% certainty that their readings were accurate, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, or NORAD, went to its highest alert level and began preparations for a retaliatory nuclear strike. Various accounts differ on what happened next. In some, leaders calmly checked the system and recognized the warning was false. However, other sources describe considerably more tension and confusion, a, quote, sense of panic, as leaders decided whether to retaliate or not. The culprit was eventually determined to be the rising moon, which unexpectedly reflected radar waves back to the Greenland-based radar. The system correctly assessed that it was seeing something big coming over the horizon, but mistakenly identified it as a Soviet nuclear attack. Fortunately, this incident did not lead to disaster, and within a few weeks, scientists developed a reliable fix for this problem, and the moon was no longer a source of false alarms. But here's what's important. This incident resulted from a problem no one had considered when the system was being designed, and that wasn't discovered until the system was actually being used. And over the years, the warning system had sprung other surprises, just as you'd expect from a large, complex system. While the United States has now hopefully sorted out many bugs like this one, there may be other surprise events that are rare enough not to have occurred yet, and that will baffle those at the warning center for longer than this one did. Diagnosing the problem and recognizing it as a false alarm, typically amid confusion and lack of information, is not something you want to have to do in a race against the clock, especially with millions of lives on the line. To learn more about other real-life tales of close calls, screw-ups, and nuclear near misses, visit act.ucsusa.org/closecalls.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Got Science podcast. Got Science is made possible by the 130,000 members of UCS, and especially our partners for the Earth, the 12,000 supporters who make monthly contributions to stand up for science. Learn more at ucsusa.org/partners. Special thanks to Dr. Richard Garwin, This Week in Science History by Katie Love, editing and music by Brian Middleton, additional editing by Omari Spears, research and writing by Pamela Worth and Jiayu Liang. Our executive producer is Rich Hayes, and I'm your host, Colleen MacDonald. Come find us on Twitter at GotScienceUCS. Thanks, and see you next time.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 9:56. Coming up next is Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. Don't forget, you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. Want a third way to listen to all your favorite KBOO programming? Then download our mobile app today. Up next here is Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, Power to Heal, Medicare and the Civil Rights Revolution. We'll feature excerpts from this powerful new hour-long documentary chronicling the historic struggle to secure equal and adequate access to health care for all Americans. I'm Dennis Bernstein again. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Delighted to be able to feature this film, narrated by Danny Glover, a powerful indication of really the way in which the Civil Rights Revolution played along with the Medicare Revolution. It's an hour-long documentary, as I said, chronicling the historic struggle to secure equal and adequate access to health care for all Americans. Central to the story is the tale of how a new national program, Medicare, was used to mount a dramatic, coordinated effort that radically changed medical support for older people and radically desegregated thousands of hospitals across the country, all in a matter of months. This happened in 1966, but it is a lesson for what could happen in the future. Listen to this.
Mm-hmm. In 1965, as the civil rights struggle escalated, Black Americans were in the streets fighting for justice and equality. They were being attacked and killed. But a different kind of violence was taking thousands of Black lives every year. Segregated medical care was a brutal reality for Black Americans.
Negroes had one ward. You were dying from cancer, if you were there to have a baby or whatever, you're on the same ward.
Everything was segregated. Not just the hospitals, but physicians' practices. I was the only Black pediatrician in the entire state.
People were dying as a result of that segregated system.
The 1964 Civil Rights Act tied federal funds to desegregation. Now Medicare, with its promise of federal funds, created an opportunity to end the shocking inequalities in medical care. This is the remarkable story of how civil rights activists and the federal government, working together, desegregated thousands of hospitals practically overnight, bringing life-saving care to millions of Americans. This little-known story reveals the role of countless people who never took center stage, but whose shoulders we stand on. For most of America's history, a system of racial segregation dictated every aspect of life. In no area was this more true than in healthcare.
You think about the civil rights movement, you think about housing, public accommodation, education. But I think the story hasn't been told often about what happened in terms of the institutions of medicine. So that's an unrevealed part of the history.
When I was 2 years old, I almost died of whooping cough